this on as well before we move to Iago's testimony. Pope also then said that Catholics do not have to breed like rabbits, and that and have more children than is safe or responsible. Yeah. Can you imagine a man in a position like this using terms like that, breed like rabbits? It's astonishing to me that somebody would view this person as a spokesperson for God, and he says that, you know, Catholics don't have to breed like rabbits. And you want to compare that man's voice to God's instructions in the Torah? Are you insane? Catholics don't have to breed like rabbits to be a good Catholic, he said. Now, he then says that there are experts in this matter. There are pastors one can seek. And I know so many, many ways out that are licit and that have helped people. Huh? I mean, it's pure gibberish. He then says, every people deserves, this is a direct quote, I'm not corrupting this, I'm not trying to dumb it down, every people deserves to conserve its identity without being ideologically colonized. Now, you look at the Roman Catholic Church as it emerged from Imperial Rome. Imperial Rome colonized the world and imposed its ideological, both political, military, and economic, as well as religious mindset on every people that it colonized. And out of that grew the Roman Catholic Church, which was even more pervasive. And if anyone under the control of Roman Catholicism tried to do anything to avoid the imposition of the Roman Catholic ideology, they weren't just taken away from society. They were mercilessly tortured by spectacle to terrorize others into compliance. I mean, there's no institution on earth that is more responsible for doing the very thing that he is condemning.
Well, yeah, maybe not. And I'd like to explain why for a second.
Okay.
When he says ideological colonization, he's not talking about indoctrination in this case, I don't think. I think what he's referring to is the effects of the historic Catholic emphasis on their anti-abortion emphasis, their emphasis on big Catholic families and a biological growth model, and on, you know, and maybe effects, say, from Western evangelicals and the anti-abortion movement. What he's saying is about, when he's saying that there are means of helping that are licit as opposed to illicit, you know, and I think he's talking about things like contraception and adoption as alternatives to, big families forswearing contraception and having large families to increase the size of the church. In other words, he's doing, once again, this guy's a loose cannon, a whack job loose cannon. He, as opposed to his predecessor, Benedict, who was the head of the College of the Doctrine of the Faith, who was a doctrinaire guy, Francis is the exact opposite. This guy's the exact opposite. He's Mr. Touchy-feely. He hasn't met a doctrine. He doesn't love the compromise. Yeah, he just wants to be every man in love by everybody inside.
Yeah, he wants to be what he was, what he achieved in Manila, which is to have people running after him and said, "We love you, Papa."
Right. He wants to be accepted by everybody, and there, he hasn't met a doctrinal compromise he doesn't like in order to gain that status.
Right. And so he's actually condemning what he set out a statement 2 weeks ago where he denounced the hierarchical nature of the Roman Catholic Church and its positions of power, and yet he holds the highest position of power in the Roman Catholic Church, and prior to that he held the second highest position of power, and he was a social climber, politically moving himself up the hierarchical nature of the Roman Catholic Church, and he hasn't denounced any of the power that comes with his position. I mean, everything the man says is moronic. It's an wholesale argument against the very institution that he represents.
Right, exactly. So he could end up, meeting with opposition as an infiltrator or something like that.
Right. Oh yeah, he's creating a cult of himself.
Right. Well,
that's what he's doing.
The Catholic Church is notoriously disingenuous in its ecumenical efforts. For example, it's common for them to send out a priest to try and woo Protestant evangelicals. And he'll go in there and he'll sling the evangelical lingo as if they're all on the same page. But
yes.
When push comes to shove, and then they get roped in, and then they whip out their we're the mother church stuff. And then,
yes.
In all the papal bulls and encyclicals, it always says there is no salvation outside the church. So all of their ecumenicism is you know, disingenuous. You know, they just always trying to woo people, and then they do a bait and switch on them and pull out their rigid doctrine later. Now,
yeah.
This guy could be really giving up the farm, but he's just coming across as a whack job who will say anything to be popular.
That is correct. He is a whack job to be popular, appealing to the fact that most people today are irrational. They're ignorant, and they're irrational. Now, Pope Francis, he went on to say, wasn't justifying violence when he said a friend who had cursed his mother could expect a punch in return. Now, so he said a friend who had insulted his mother should expect to be punched. Rather, he says, no. I wasn't expressing violence or encouraging violence by saying that a man who cursed his mother should be punched. I was just saying that's a very human response to a provocation, and that greater prudence would have avoided such an offense. In other words, what he's saying is that had the man not offended his mother, his friend, not offended his mother, then he wouldn't be deserving of the punch. But then he transitions to that to talk about his comments on the limits of free speech that he made in response to the Islamic attack on the French magazine Charlie Hebdo. So speaking to reporters Monday en route from the Philippines, Francis said, quote, in theory, we can say a violent reaction to an offense or provocation isn't a good thing. Now, by the way, there was no offense. And there was no attempt to provoke. There was an attempt to communicate a vital truth. That Muhammad, the lone founder, the singular voice of Islam, was a sexual pervert and a mass murdering terrorist. That's not an offense. To suggest that Charlie Hebdo did something that was offensive shows that this man has no clue who Muhammad was. That we should say, in theory, that a violent reaction to an offense isn't a good thing. In theory, we can say that we have the freedom to express ourselves. In theory only, we have the freedom to express ourselves. But we are human. There is prudence, which is a virtue of human coexistence. In other words, he is condemning Charlie Hebdo for the attack on them.
Well, I would say, I don't like the stuff that Charlie Hebdo puts out, and I don't like the interview by Sony and stuff like that. And I think, I think it's just tap dancing and avoiding the issue. It's like when you are goading a known violent drunk to expect a fight in the alley, you know, instead of phrasing it in this namby-pamby, you know, phraseology about all of human responses and trying to make it general. He's talking about when you piss off, you know, North Koreans who are highly militant, or when you goad and poke in the ribs Muslims who declare their intentions to be but to respond violently, you should expect what they told you they would do or the way they historically act. So he's being kind of wimpy and trying to couch this in humanistic terms. He's talking about goading two specific, you know, I'm including the North Koreans. When you go, you know, when you make a movie about killing a nation's leader, that nation is militant and insular, you can expect, you know, a pretty, you know, a marked response. And especially when you provoke Muslims about images of Muhammad, and you know there's historical precedent for knowing that this causes problems, you shouldn't be surprised when the violent entity you're provoking reacts violently.
Yeah.
You know,
to say that you're not surprised that Muslims became murderous, and somehow blaming, which is what he's inferring here, Charlie Hebdo for causing the death of their editorial staff and founder. Those are miles apart. You know, when I wrote Prophet of Doom, I knew that I would receive death threats. I knew it was the right thing to do. Did I know that the truth about Muhammad, using Muhammad's own words and deeds to expose and condemn Muhammad, knowing that by putting the Quran into the context of Muhammad's life and reordering it chronologically according to the Hadith, that that would inflame Muslims, even though the entire book was based on their scriptures, the oldest, most credible sources, and that it was the best documented, most comprehensive and chronological presentation of their scriptures ever written? Did I know for certain that it was not only going to provoke Muslims, but that they would threaten to kill me as a result of doing so? Absolutely. But it was the right thing to do. Charlie Hebdo knew that depicting Muhammad as inspiring terrorism and as a sexual pervert would inspire a violent Islamic reaction. It was the right thing to do. Now, I think I wrote Prophet of Doom for the right reasons, and I expressed the condemnation of Muhammad in the right way. I used evidence and reason. I used sound moral judgment throughout that presentation. Charlie Hebdo did not. That's why you and I would not defend Charlie Hebdo as a credible magazine. Most of what they did from a zealous religious position, and the truth didn't matter.
But they fired off their rhetorical attack nukes and didn't prepare for response. They were horrifically naive, just as Patton Tillman was horrifically naive. If you're going to go to the masses with an entity like this, then you lose your naivete. And Salman Rushdie has the presence of mind to get the heck out of Dodge and deal with the problem, get out of the worm's way. These people fired off their rhetorical attack nukes and sat back, expecting nothing to happen.
They knew it was going to happen. They were almost bankrupt because of the protection services that they had to acquire as a result of doing these depictions. They knew for certain what was going to happen after witnessing what happened, and I don't know if it was in the Netherlands or in Norway, but around the Baltic with the magazine that depicted Muhammad with the bomb in his headdress. No, they knew, and they experienced immediately what was going to happen. Hey, friend, listening to this program, and noting that most of us who have studied the Torah as Yahweh intended, according to the teachings that has been provided to us in the 119th Psalm. For those who don't listen to the Friday Shabbat program, the 119th Psalm is by far the longest psalm. It is a song devoted entirely to how to observe the Torah. And it focuses on what's important in the Torah and how we should consider it and respond to it. It's a powerful explanation from God through the prophet Dode, known as David, on the best means to observe the Torah. And it, of course, was written by a man who did not obey the Torah. He was guilty of all manner of violations of the Torah, but who is the single most beloved figure in all of human history by God, and a man who God says is righteous and vindicated because he not only observed the Torah, but responded to it appropriately. And so our conclusion, based upon God's instruction, is that the Torah is to be observed, closely examined, and carefully considered, not obeyed. And it's instruction to be considered, not laws to be obeyed. The Torah does not mean law. It means instruction and teaching. And the Hebrew word shema that is translated obeyed, it's not actually translated, but changed to obeyed in English translations, means to listen. Doesn't mean to obey. And shamar, which means to observe, does not mean to keep. So we, in at least one full program, and maybe two on the Shabbat program, we're analyzing the basis, the what we can learn from the instructions on food. And I have to tell you that when I went into that program, and it was now months and months ago that we did this program, if you want to listen to it, the blessyahweh.com site, by Richard, who's a listener and participant in both the programs. Site will have that that show from the Yada Yada Radio designated and available for you to listen. And I went into it with great fear and trepidation. Fear and trepidation in the sense that, you know, I'm not a guy that has much fear and I don't worry about much thing. But I was concerned because I was uncomfortable trying to assert my view on something that I know many people find extraordinarily divisive. And my view was that even in the instruction on food, that all Yahweh said was that certain things are good for you to eat and some things are not good for you to eat. And that was really all he said. And that the things that were identifiable on the these are good to eat side, digested their food, processed their food in such a way as to get the maximum amount of nutrition from it, and their hooves were designed to show a set apartness, a distinction, a separation from other animals, and therefore we could learn a ton from what God had to say. That was the repetitive nature of what was good to eat. But also, if you looked at what was not healthy to eat, of those animals that are known to us, they were, in fact, not healthy to eat and dangerous for us until really the last 50 years or so. And so, realizing that three of the animals on the list of what mammals on the side of the list of what was not good for you to eat don't exist, didn't exist, have never existed, I realized, I came to the conclusion anyway, that there was a lot we could learn from the list that Yahweh provided, and that there were instructions here to guide us as opposed to rules to follow. And so that's how I presented it, and I think the evidence for that conclusion was strong. But still, I understand there's a lot of people that just say, God said don't eat pork, so I'm not going to eat pork. So a listener to both programs who I'm certain, views Yahweh's instructions regarding food the same way that I do. And I'm not in any way here, shape, or form telling you that you need to agree with me. I am simply providing in that show and what I'm going to say next, this translation, you with something to think about. But it is rather profound what God had to say in the book of Devarim, which is the concluding book of the Torah, about food. And we'll return to that in a moment. A segment about food instructions. In Devarim, what we find, in Devarim means words. Devar is the Hebrew word for words, and Devarim means words, plural. The YM ending makes it plural. And recognizing that Devarim is Yahweh's inspiring Moshe to summarize, not only summarize the important aspects of the Torah, but to help convey the Torah from the perspective that he is emphasizing what's most important for us to understand, and to convey it in a way that helps us apply what has been communicated in the Torah. That's the purpose of Devarim. And in Devarim 12:15, I'm going to begin just with a quick review of Devarim 12:14, and then go into great detail in Devarim 12:15. In Devarim 12:14, it says, "Surely, truly, with regard to the place that Yahweh will choose among all of your tribes," this would be the 12 tribes of Israel, "there you should lift up that which elevates. And there you should engage in and act upon all that I am instructing. Okay? So there we should lift up that which elevates, and we should engage in and act upon all of Yahweh's instructions. And he's speaking to the children of Israel in the land that Yahweh was going to provide for them, which was Israel. All right. Then this. Except. So there's an instruction here, because the last part was Shawa, which Shawa means a direction, something that was prescribed that teaches and guides. So, except rock. However, noting this exclusive, singular, and unique incidence as an exception. So there's an exception to the instruction that Yahweh has provided in his book of instructions called the Torah, that he's saying that we don't have to act upon this one exception to the instruction and guidance that he has provided, except rock. With every sign that points something out, denoting a desire. So he's referring to this one thing is a sign, something that designates something, something that denotes a person's desire or will. It's the Hebrew word is anoh. It means a measure and depiction which denotes a preference for being called out and marked. A description which sets someone apart based upon a fondness for a desirable and pleasing yearning. So, this is simplistically translated craving or desire, but it's really the core of the word, the root of the word, is a sign, a mark, something that is that designates you as unique and special. So, except with everything that denotes you as unique and special, that's an expression of what you find desirable, of your soul, nefesh. You may actually, so with that mindset, you may actually and continually butcher zavah. You may on an ongoing basis kill and then prepare for literal consumption. This is the call imperfect. And also, you may choose to completely consume, or maybe another way to render this, because it was in the call perfect consecutive. You may, under the auspices of free will, elect to at a particular time to eat. You see, the call stem speaks of that which is literal and genuine, actual. The perfect conjugation speaks of an act devoted, designated for a specific period of time. That time can be past, present, or future, but it's not for all time. It's for a particular period of time. So for a particular period of time, you may choose to completely consume creatures, the flesh, this is bizarre, the flesh of living things and of animals, in connection with the blessing and superlative gift, this is baraka, the excellent nature of the vow which results in reconciliation and the internal benefits of the covenant by willingness of Yahweh, your God, to kneel down, which is a benefit of the relationship he has provided to you. In any reasoned out and thoughtful conclusion in any city or town, Ba'kol Sha'ar. Now, Sha'ar is usually translated within your gates. But Sha'ar itself, the root of the word, means to reason out, to draw a thoughtful conclusion after using all means of thinking. And Yahweh defines thinking as bien, which is making connections between things. So it's in any gated area or public space where people assemble for living, and by all means of thinking, the unclean, hatame, the impure, and also the clean. consistent with the beautiful, and this is Sabi, the beautiful, the desirable and valuable, the glorious. Now, you're going to read your English translation here of 12:5 or 12:15, and you're going to see the buck. But the word means consistent with that which is beautiful, desirable, and valuable, that which is glorious, consistent with the beautiful nature, the desirable and valuable nature, the glorious nature, and in harmony with the leader. Hiel. Now, you'll read this in your English translation as rather than buck, you'll read stag. I just was curious. I asked Scott, hey, while I'm finishing this translation, give me a favor and look up buck and stag. I think a buck and a stag are the same thing. You know, they're typically a male deer would be a buck or a stag. And indeed, they're the same thing. One sometimes is considered a little larger than the others, but they're the same thing. And so this says, and consistent with, now you can take buck and stag, consistent with the buck and the stag, or you can take the core meaning of the words, consistent with the beautiful, the desirable and valuable, the glorious, and in harmony with, consistent with the leader, Ha'el, the lamb, the mighty pillar, the doorway, the protective covering, the source of power, strength, and vigorous life. Or you can render that stag. And he may genuinely and consistently be nourished by him. He may literally and always consume what he provides that is valuable. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what this tells us, at least based upon a comprehensive, thoughtful rendering of these words, consistent with the sounds, the conjugations, and the moods that were applied to the verbs, and the full and literal meaning of the words, the primary meaning of the words, is that Yahweh, through Moshe, in the Torah, in Devarim, has told us that he does want us to act upon his instructions. He wants us to engage in what he has provided by way of directions. Particularly as we move into the land that Yahweh has provided, because that was the context. But there is an exception to acting upon what Yahweh has instructed. There is an exception. And that exception is that so long as we are very thoughtful about it, so long as we use our minds to examine what God said and learn from it, that there would be a time and place, and I suggest it's the last 50 years, where we are absolutely and unequivocally able to eat that which was designated as unclean, so long as we understand God's instructions on the matter. And so long as we recognize that there will be a time and place where we should recognize Yahweh's nature as beautiful, as desirable, as valuable, as glorious, and that he is the lamb, the leader, the mighty pillar, the doorway, the protective covering, the source of power, and that as such, since he has provided these things, there is a time when it's appropriate to consume them, and that is the lone exception to his instructions. Well, pretty tough to argue with that, isn't it? Now, I have a good friend who participates in this program quite often. A friend that I have gotten to know through these shows and through email, I've never met in person, is Larry, who calls in quite often from Florida. And Larry gets a lot of flack because he is even more vocal than I am about the recognition that Yahweh's Torah is teaching, not law, and that it needs to be examined and considered, not obeyed. And therefore, he is, on occasion, will have a little pepperoni on his pizza. And he gets a lot of flack. People say, well, you're not Torah observant if you're doing that. Oh, yes, he is. Oh, yes, he is. What this says is that God made this an exception. And for this time and this place. And if we were to religiously change our diet, that would actually be counterproductive. It would indicate laws to be obeyed. And the concluding comments to this, I've shared with you the transitional statement into it that we should act upon and engage based upon all of the instructions and directions that Yahweh has provided, and that we should uplift that which is uplifting, that we should uphold that which is uplifting. The concluding statement that transitions out of this is Devarim 12:16. It says, only the blood you must not consume. So, you can eat what was listed as an unclean animal. Just the blood you must not consume. You must have it pour out on the ground as if it were water. So, that's happens to be an attack on Roman Catholicism, where they are convinced that they have turned the wine, that their priests perform a miracle and turn the wine into the blood of their God. And Yahweh is saying, you must not drink the blood. Pour it out. What's interesting is, why would Yahweh highlight this one instruction and saying, you know, when it comes to you, to a particular period of time, I want you to realize that you can eat clean and unclean animals. I think it's twofold. One is, there are very few instructions of the Torah that are as enlightening as are those that pertain to what's good for us to consume and not good for us to consume. Because if your perspective is, this is a law to obey, then you're going to have a tendency to misinterpret the entirety of the Torah. And if you focus on those as instructions to learn from, to be guided by, that which is, if you consume that which is good, that which is helps you really fully be nourished, and that separates you from others, if you do that, that's good. And if you consume rubbish, and animals that eat trash, for example, if you consume rubbish and that which is not good for you, like you believe the diatribe of this pope, or the mantra of American propaganda regarding the military, and that's bad. That's going to really mess you up. If your view is, in perspective, is like that, then you're going to benefit not only from those instructions on what's good and bad for you to consume, but on the totality of the Torah. And which is why this concludes with that what we should do when we're eating that which is unclean is to recognize that Yahweh is beautiful and that we ought to consume that which he provides that is valuable and beautiful, that he's our leader and that he has liberated us and he's empowered us and he has enlightened us. And all of the words that conclude that statement indicate that. And I think that those who have turned diet into kosher food laws and made a religion out of it. That in so doing, or using the food instructions to create a litmus test of who is and is not Torah observant, that such individuals have created a stumbling block to appreciating the purpose and merit of the Torah, which is to guide and to teach, to instruct. And they say, well, okay, I'm with you on all that guide and instruction part, but this is something we ought to obey. No. The moment you go there, then you've corrupted the entire intent of the Torah. And so I think that's why this is the lone exception. Is don't make a religion out of this. Don't establish any aspect of the Torah as a law to be obeyed. View it all as an expression of free will, of doing what your soul desires because it's good for you, of listening to your Heavenly Father, of learning from Him, of thoughtfully analyzing and considering what He has to say, so that you can be nourished by the source of all goodness. A powerful insight, and I want to thank Chuck for sending this along to us today. May God bless.